This week on the Breezy Breakfast Radio Hour, we hear from Guelph MPP Mike Schreiner. Mike discusses issues related to healthcare, including long-term care and the current crisis created by the government moving people to long-term care facilities, which are 70 to 150 kilometers away from where they live. Mike comments on the principle of the strong mayor, unanimously denounced by Guelph City Council this past week. Mike explains why he said the following. I voted no to the third reading of the strong mayor's bill. Concentrating power at the top will do little to address the housing crisis. We need urgent action to end exclusionary zoning, make fourplexes, and increase government spending on affordable and supportive housing. Mike talks about issues of importance locally and provincially. Learn more about Highway 413 and why this project does more for developers and a handful of landowners than it does for the environment and Ontario residents.
Good morning and welcome to Breezy Breakfast on Thursday, September 15th, 2022. Today, our MPP Mike Schreiner is joining us to get us up to speed on what's going on in Queen's Park. As we gather, we acknowledge that there are 46 treaties and other agreements that cover the territory now called Ontario. We are thankful to be able to work and live in these territories. We are thankful to the First Nations, Métis, and Inuit people who have cared for these territories since time immemorial and who continue to contribute to the strength of Ontario and to all communities across the province. Guelph is situated on treaty land and home to many First Nations, Inuit, and Métis people today. As a city, we have a responsibility for the stewardship of the land on which we live, work, and play. Acknowledging traditional Indigenous territories is one way to recognize contemporary and historical Indigenous presence and land rights. It is a small step towards dismantling the continued aspects of colonialism and undoing Indigenous erasure in our everyday lives. So I would like to welcome Mike Schreiner, one of the hardest working MPPs in the province. The legislature has been back in session for about a month, and many bills 1 to 22, are on the agenda. What I consider the bills of particular importance are number 2, Plan to Build Act, number 3, Strong Mayors Building Homes Act. This act is mired in controversy, to say the least. Indeed, last night, Guelph Council passed a motion to unanimously oppose it. Bill 7 is called the More Beds, Better Care Act. Number 14 is the No Time to Waste Act, a plan for climate action and jobs. Bill 21 is called Fixing Long-Term Care Amendment Act. And in parentheses, it's Till Death Do Us Part. And the award for the bill with the most interesting title goes to Bill 1, an act to perpetuate an ancient parliamentary right. So with that, I cede the floor to you, Mike, to get us up to speed on the good, the bad, and the ugly in Queen's Park. Please know that I will be asking you to clarify 1, 2, or 3 of the bills that I have just mentioned.
Yeah, well, thank you. I had the privilege of being one of the people to speak yesterday, and I ended my comments with, I didn't phrase it as a challenge, but maybe a challenge to the new king to really focus on healing our relationships with each other and healing our relationship with this place we call home, planet Earth. And I think in order to accomplish the latter, we need to heal our relationships with Indigenous peoples. And I'm hoping that that's a conversation that, you know, we continue to have and we accelerate that conversation as we move forward here at Queen's Park and just, you know, across Canada and around the world, frankly. I will dig into a few of the bills that you mentioned, but I don't think I'm going to go into each and every single one of them. But all of them are very relevant to the conversations that have been happening at Queen's Park. And so I'm going to start with healthcare, because I'm in healthcare and long-term care, because that's what's really dominated the summer sitting and probably is the most urgent issue that people are facing. And just a couple of things I want to make really clear, and I've done this in the past, but I'll just state it again, that I'm opposed to further privatization of our healthcare system. I believe that we should have a publicly funded, publicly delivered healthcare system. And, you know, if people want to ask during the Q&A, I can get into some of the concerns I have around the existing privatization that we have in our healthcare system, because quite a bit of it actually, I think more of it is private than people realize. And I would say that the biggest solution to the health, the crisis we're facing in healthcare, and many of you have probably seen it, you know, record wait times in emergency rooms, you know, the fact that in some cases ERs have closed over the summer, is really a health human resource issue. And that's being driven primarily by, if I could come up, give you another bill number, Bill 124, which is legislation that caps wages and benefits for nurses and other frontline healthcare workers and public sector workers in general at 1%. And I always like to emphasize that that's wages and benefits. So if you think of frontline healthcare workers, for example, who have experienced a significant amount of trauma over the last 2.5 years of the pandemic, they can't even negotiate, you know, more access to mental health care services for themselves, for example, because their benefits as well as the wages are being capped. And, you know, one of the reasons so many people are retiring early or leaving the profession is, you know, they're overworked, underpaid, and working in very challenging working conditions, many times short staffed. And, you know, to me, the two best solutions to that are, one, allow people to bargain for fair wages, fair benefits, and better working conditions. And many of you probably heard a number of unions have now taken the government to court around Bill 124, which, you know, if you look at past court decisions, likely will be ruled as unconstitutional and a violation of collective bargaining rights, which are in the charter. So once again, the Ford government is going to waste millions of our dollars fighting battles in the courts instead of just doing the right thing and repealing the bill and allowing, you know, healthcare workers to and other public sector workers to negotiate fair wages. And then the second one is to really fast track and accelerate accreditation of internationally trained healthcare providers. According to the Registered Nurses Association, we have anywhere between 15 to 20,000 internationally trained healthcare workers, nurses, doctors, PSWs, and others, who could be working in healthcare to help alleviate the human resource capacity issues we're facing. And so to me, that's the first start. And then we can go into a whole host of other ones. But to me, those are the two most important. And then all of this relates to Bill 7, which is probably the most controversial bill. And for those of you who didn't have a chance to hear the government's announcement, they did announce the regulations around Bill 7. And essentially what Bill 7 does is it enables hospitals to essentially put pressure on elders to go to a long-term care home, not of their choosing. And if the person refuses to do that, they will be charged $400 a day, or to put that more succinctly, $12,000 a month. Think about that. You know, who can afford $400 a day? Who can afford $12,000 a month? And the government also put, basically said that anybody in Southern Ontario can be transported within a 75 kilometer radius, in Northern Ontario, 150 kilometer radius. And so to me, I just think it's wrong that the government's putting really its own mismanagement of the healthcare system and lack of investment in the healthcare system, that they're asking or forcing elders to pay the price for that. And I think it's just wrong to, you know, threaten and essentially enforce what I would call forced consent onto elders to possibly go to a long-term care home that they don't feel is safe or that is so far away from family that they're not going to get the additional care support they need. And I actually think it's going to put more pressure and make the situation in long-term care even worse, partly because due to the staff shortages in long-term care, many residents rely on family, friends, and other caregivers to support them. And, you know, if you have to travel 150 kilometers to like go take care of your loved one, you're not going to do that trip every day. You're just not going to be able to afford to. You're not going to be able to have the time to do it. Even 75 kilometers, especially given, you know, traffic congestion and things like that in the GTHA. And so I think it's actually going to put even more pressure on long-term care homes and the people who work in those homes and the residents. And so to me, it'd be much better off if the government invested more in home and community care so elders could leave hospital and be cared for in their homes, and or investing more in nonprofit and municipally owned long-term care so we actually have long-term care homes that elders want to go to and feel safe going to. And so if people want to dig into that a bit more, happy to do that. I will say, somewhat related to all this, and I was a part of, and I know Phil was there, he was on a panel that I was on, and I think many municipal council candidates and existing councilors, along with the mayor, were at a youth mental health forum that took place in Guelph a couple of days ago. Right now, addressing the mental health crisis, not only for youth, but for people of all ages, is a real top priority for me. I've been pushing really hard to provide additional funding to increase staffing for mental health services. I mean, I've talked to people all throughout the healthcare sector saying that we just simply don't have enough people who are trained and in positions to be able to provide, to meet the demand and the need for mental health services in our community and across the province, especially for young people. Like the average wait time right now for a youth to access mental health services is 18 months and can be as long as 2.5 years. So, I mean, imagine somebody, you know, maybe feeling, having suicidal ideation, for example, and not being able to access care for 2.5 years in some cases, to me is just wrong. And so I've been saying, let's hire more mental health care providers, and let's start transitioning mental health to be part of the OHIP system. Because even when people are able to access care services, oftentimes they're not able to afford it. And so if mental health is health, which I believe it is, then it should be part of OHIP. And so those are things I'm going to be continuing to push for. But I will say there is a lot of good work happening in our community, where you know, social service agencies, organizations like the Rotary Club, private sector supporters, the city itself, elected officials at all levels of government are really coming together and working hard to address issues around mental health and addictions, especially for youth. And then connected to that is housing. And I just want to talk briefly that I'm very excited that we have 3 permanent supportive housing projects on the go in Guelph. We have the funding in place to actually build them. The big challenge will be additional operational funding, and that will have to come from the province. And so that's been a top priority for me, and working really hard on that. And I'm cautiously optimistic. I think given what Guelph is doing and all the partners at play, that I think, I've been pushing that Guelph could really be an example of how other communities can come together to really address the housing crisis that we're facing and the need for wraparound mental health addictions and other supports for people, in addition to providing a roof over their head. And I'm just going to close because I really want to leave time for questions, is Bill 2, which is essentially the government's budget bill. The fact that it has a highway on its cover probably tells you everything you need to know about it. I like to say to people that if you're a car, Bill 2 is a great bill. If you're a person, maybe not so good. If you believe in climate action, I'd say Bill 2 is pretty awful. You know, to invest $25 billion in new highways at a time that we're facing a climate emergency, and we need those funds to go into healthcare, education. I would say doubling ODSP rates so we don't force people to live in legislative poverty. And climate action would be much more fiscally responsible, strategic, and people-centered investments. And so I want to invite all of you. A big part of that, Bill, is to lay the groundwork to construct Highway 413, which many of you probably know will pave over 400 acres of the Greenbelt, 2,000 acres of farmland, destroy 65 wetlands at a time when we've already destroyed 75% of wetlands in Southern Ontario, and unleash sprawl development on thousands and thousands of additional acres of farmland, really to primarily benefit 8 land speculators who will turn millions into billions. And, you know, I keep saying that, you know, we shouldn't be building billion-dollar highways to million-dollar homes that nobody can afford. Why don't we actually build affordable housing in our existing communities so we can address the housing crisis without forcing people into long, expensive commutes and without paving over the farmland that feeds us and the wetlands that protect us from flooding? And so on October 1st, I'm a part of working with a number of environmental NGOs, community organizations, grassroots organizations to organize a harvest walk that will go along parts of the Highway 413 route. I've invited, because I want it to be multi-partisan, cross-partisan, so I've invited, or we've invited NDP and Liberals to participate, and they've agreed. So all 3 opposition parties will be participating. And I the last I heard, we've already had over 600 people say they're going to be a part of the walk. So if any of you can join, you can go to gpo.ca to access information about it. But if you don't want to go to a partisan website, Environmental Defense, so if you go to their website, has information about it, and they're actually running full page ads to advertise it. So we're hoping to get a huge crowd of people, because we know that despite the fact that 18% of the population voted in a Ford majority government, that we know the vast majority of people in Ontario, or at least over 50% of the people, according to polling data, are opposed to Highway 413. And I think we need to send a clear message to the government that we don't want them to spend billions of dollars paving over our future and the places we love and the, you know, the land that feeds us and protects us from flooding. And so I know it's an issue that many folks in Guelph care deeply about, and certainly encourage you to participate. And if you're unable to participate, because I know that that may be the kind of event that doesn't work for everyone, please help get the word out. And I just want you all to know that even though the Ford government thinks that this highway is a done deal, it is not a done deal. And I'm going to do everything I can to stop it, because it really is so destructive. So anyway, I'm going to leave it at that, and happy to answer questions.
Thank you, Mike. I'm going to continue the discussion with regard to Highway 413. And so the first things that came to my mind, given that Ford does have a majority, how likely is it for Highway 413 to not be built? You mentioned the walk, the harvest walk, which is great, and the links to show our support for the Green Belt and farmland. Will that message be listened to, make a difference? And how is it not a done deal? Because I have a hard time believing that it isn't.
Yeah, so there's a two-pronged strategy. So one, the federal government will do an environmental assessment. And so that will delay construction of the highway. And so part of the need to build a political movement is to put pressure on the federal government to not only do a partial environmental assessment, but to do a full environmental assessment. And one of the arguments that puts this into federal jurisdiction is there are 11 endangered species that have been identified along the route of the highway, which is grounds for triggering a full federal environmental assessment. So the federal government could say no to it, or at the very least, the environmental assessment could delay the project and or if it does go through, force it to have a less destructive route than it has right now. One thing that I've brought up on more than one occasion is the premier actually rerouted the highway to make it even more destructive to help protect some land from, you know, a major deep-pocketed developer who also happens to be a donor to the Conservative Party. But anyway, so one is, if we're going to put pressure on the federal government to do that, I think they need to see the fact that there's strong public opposition. So that's one. Two is, the Ford government does have a history of backing down on projects where there is significant opposition. Now, I will admit, they haven't backed down on one that they've so publicly committed to as this one. And there was the very first private members business that we dealt with in this parliament was a resolution from a member from Brampton North in support of Highway 413. And so the Ford government doubled down in voting for that motion. But they do have a history of backing down in the face of significant opposition. And one of the interesting elements of the debate was the conservative framing of it was that a bunch of downtown Toronto woke elites are the ones opposed to 413. And so I did point out that I've never considered myself an elite, and I'm a downtown Guelphite, and that there are a lot of people from outside of Toronto who are opposed to this highway. So one of the motivations for the Harvest Walk is that, you know, a lot of the people participating will be people who live there, and so I think we need to show the government that that it's local residents in addition to others across the province who are opposed to it, and so. This highway is so destructive from a climate perspective, from a food security perspective, from a just really gross misallocation of limited financial resources perspective, that I don't think we can give up, or at least I can't give up the fight, especially knowing that there is a real chance that we can stop this highway.
Okay, so what I'm hearing is, the more pressure we put on the Ford government and consistent pressure, this may make a difference. And the more pressure we put on the federal government to do a full environmental assessment will also help the opposition to this highway. I would like to ask you, how much authority does the federal government actually have? I mean, they can do an environmental assessment, but does the provincial government have to abide by it?
Yeah, I mean, the provincial government could potentially try to take the federal government to court. And, you know, the Ford government has a history of doing things like that. But the federal government has authority here. There are identified endangered species which trigger a federal environmental assessment. The federal government has already announced that they will review it. And so I know that, I'm assuming the federal government's going to face a significant amount of pressure to do a full environmental assessment. So we'll see how that plays out. I mean, that's not guaranteed. They may decide not to do that. So, you know, but I think it's important for the public to speak out and to be heard. I mean, that's democracy, and that's people's democratic right to be able to speak out and voice their opposition to something that, you know, that they're opposed to and that they don't feel like is a good use of their tax dollars.
Absolutely. Thank you for answering that. I would like to sort of change topics to the long-term care bill. One question I have is it wrong to move people to long-term care if and only if these facilities are in close proximity to their communities? Like if you lived in Guelph, would it be okay, for lack of a better word, to go to a long-term care facility in Guelph? And I guess what underlies my question is this bill underpinned by, you know, a matter of distance, funding, or just general disdain for the public?
Yeah, so you know what, I'm going to try to answer this question in a way that is not overly partisan, okay? Because this is a really serious and complex issue. So having people in hospital who would be better cared, who no longer need to be in hospital because they are not facing an acute health issue, it would be much better for them to be cared for at home or in a long-term care home. So I just want to be clear about that. And that's an issue that hospitals have, and you know, people in the healthcare system in general have talked about for years. So this is an issue that like predates the current government. And really highlights why it is so important that additional investments be made in expanding home care, home and community care services and long-term care. Okay. What is different here is the government now has given, you know, hospitals and are really pushing hospitals at this point to push seniors out of hospital to go to a long-term care home, not of their choosing. And so usually what happens is people have five choices and they can be put in any one of those five choices. And sometimes, and oftentimes, and this has historically been the case, you know, people are not able to access their first choice because there's just not a space available for them. But what this can do is push people and force people to go to a home that is not part of their top five choices. And so to me, that's the biggest issue is we've always worked on a basis of consent, where people consent to go and they consent to go to one of their top five. And while the legislation and the government keeps saying that they're maintaining consent, I would argue that it's forced consent to say to somebody, if you don't go, we're going to charge you $400 a day, or I've been saying $12,000 a month if you just want to sort of look at monthly fees. So that to me is not consent. And where the distance comes in is that a lot of family members visit their loved ones every day. Not all family members do, but many do, to provide additional care and comfort, because a lot of people know that not all, but many of our long-term care homes are understaffed and their loved ones aren't getting the care and attention that they would receive if the home was fully staffed. And so I want to be careful not to criticize long-term care homes either, because a lot of those folks are doing the best they can under huge pressure. And so where the distance comes in is if you just don't have the time or the money to be able to travel those distances, you're not going to be able to provide that enhanced care for your loved ones. And I think that, and it's not just me, I mean, we've had people in the long-term care sector express this concern that they recognize what a vital role loved ones play in the care of elders, and to potentially lose that, I think is going to put additional pressure on the long-term care homes. And so from my perspective, the government is using a sledgehammer to address an issue that really is more complicated than that, but that is a real issue. Like it is an issue that hospitals are dealing with, and they do want to make sure that acute care beds are going to acute care patients. And so I just think there are better ways of addressing this that show the respect that our elders deserve and provide the care that our elders deserve.
You mentioned home care, and I agree with you that that can be the best option for many elderly people. But is home care and financing for that an option for most patients? And I guess what I'm asking is, and I don't know this, so it might be a quite ignorant question, but does the government at all help people to finance for home care? And if it doesn't, or if it only does a little bit, because I know there's the LIN network where, you know, you have PSWs coming in like twice a week to help do basic things, but would it help to put more money into that immediately?
Yeah, so there is government-funded home care for people. For a lot of people, they would say that care is insufficient. Not for everyone, but for a number of people. And I should say that not everyone is able to be cared for at home, which is why we need long-term care homes for people with really complex care needs. But for a lot of elders and people with disabilities, who are pushed into long-term care homes would prefer to be cared for at home if the resources and services were available. So the government has provided some funding for people to renovate their homes to make them accessible, to address accessibility issues. And there are government funding for the provision of home care services. One of the challenges in home care is that PSWs and nurses who work in home care tend to be paid less. So we're already having issues around wage restraint, which are even more so for people who work in home and community care. And in some cases, those care providers, in many cases, they're not paid for their travel time. So think about you're traveling from home to home to home throughout the course of your day, and you're not being paid for all of that. In some cases, people aren't even compensated for their travel either. So like not in all cases. So there are some real challenges within the home care system in terms of treating home care workers, whether nurses or PSWs, with the respect and, you know, dignity and financial fairness they deserve. And then in some cases, because there's such limited time, the care becomes very quick and it's kind of in and out. And that's not any fault of the care provider, the person providing the care. It's just the reality of the schedule they're facing. So I will say that in Bill 2, there is an immediate and significant increase in funding for home care in the budget. So, you know, if you were speaking to a member of the Conservative Party right now, they would say, hey, we're putting in a whole bunch of money into home care. And your member from Guelph voted against it. So that's generally what they would say. I voted against the budget for a lot of other good reasons. But even with that infusion of money, it's still really it's making up for underfunding in home and community care over decades. And so there's a lot of resource catch up that needs to happen. And I would argue from a fiscally responsible perspective that it's money well invested. It is far less expensive to care for people in their homes than in hospital. So this is money well spent. So, you know, and I realize the payback on that may be further down the line. Like there's the immediate payback of providing, you know, immediate, better and enhanced care. And there's the immediate issue around, making more hospital beds available. But this is oftentimes a longer term issue as well. But it's an important investment that will take pressure off of our hospitals.
Yes, and unfortunately, humans in general, and maybe some politicians in particular, tend to take the short view, right? So what saves money now is better, quote unquote, than what will save money down the road. And that is unfortunate. I have so many other questions with regards to healthcare, but what I'm hearing from you is give nurses proper remuneration, right? Go against Bill 124.
Yep.
And what I heard is that they are taking the Ford government to court, right? With regards to that, and to fast track foreign doctors and nurses to become accredited in Canada. So both of those things are going to take some time. Immediate solutions, there's one for home care, but I would like to bring up, I read in Guelph today that the Guelph Emergency Department did hire a couple of nurses, I guess from the private nurses to immediately address the lack of nurses in the ER. And I know this is, I tread carefully when I ask this question, because if I were in the ER, I don't care where the nurses come from. And my question is, as an immediate solution, is it at all, I don't know how to put it, because obviously we don't want to have that. And maybe once that's in place, it's hard to get rid of, right? But as an immediate solution, we're looking for that. And if all I see is, money into home care, I'm a little bit deflated about what's happening in a hospital. I guess that's more of a comment, and that's for a different show, right?
Well, let me unpack that a little bit. So first of all, we need more investment in hospitals too. And just in the context of just in Guelph, I'm working really hard. Guelph General deserves the credit for this. I'm just helping and advocating. They have received funding to expand the emergency room, and they also have received approval to go to the next stage of planning for a new hospital. So I'm not suggesting that only investing in home and community care is going to solve this crisis. We need additional investments in hospital, but the two have to go hand in hand. So on the issue of hiring nurses from private agencies, the hospitals have been forced into doing this. And some of the hospitals in Toronto, as part of the University Health Network, have spent like $6 million extra dollars, for example, in the first half of the year in hiring agents, what's called agency nurses. And so agency nurses have always been a part of the system, but generally they've only been used just for like just quick fill-ins or in a real emergency situation, et cetera. But it's becoming a more day-to-day part of our healthcare system, partly driven by Bill 124. So you have a lot of nurses who are working full-time. They want to work full-time. But in the course of doing that work, because they've been just short-staffed for so long now during the pandemic, are feeling overworked, underpaid, and underappreciated. And they can leave their full-time work and go work for a private agency and make substantially more money on a per hour basis, have more flexibility in terms of their working hours, not having to work so many shifts, double shifts, et cetera. And so you can see why some nurses are choosing to leave full-time permanent work, and in many cases, unfortunately, having to give up their seniority and their pensions and their benefits, but are doing it to make more money per hour and to have more flexibility in their work schedule. So they have more time with their family in many cases. And so that's actually leading to more shortages in the full-time workers, which then puts hospital administrators in an incredibly difficult situation, because you're absolutely right. The administration at Guelph General, they're going to do what they have to do to keep the ER open, to care for patients. They're not going to let people, you know, not receive healthcare. And so the healthcare administrators are being forced into hiring agency nurses. And so this is where I get really frustrated with the whole argument around like healthcare costs too much money, or we don't have enough money or whatever. We're actually spending more money to hire private agency nurses than if we'd actually just invested the money in the system itself in the first place. And much of that is being driven by Bill 124. And so this is why I think it is so important. And even if the government tomorrow said, hey, we are getting rid of Bill 124, it's not going to immediately fix the crisis tomorrow, because this has been building over a few years now. But it would send an important signal to those frontline healthcare workers who are currently in the system that there is hope for change now, that there will be an opportunity to negotiate better wages, better working conditions, better benefits. I mean, right now, even if you're a hospital administrator and you're negotiating, you know, you if you want to pay your nurses more money, you can't, because the government won't let you. So it's like, even for those who would rather put the money there, they legally can't. And so that would at least send a signal of hope. And I also think it would also, and this isn't just me speculating, this is conversations with nurses and other frontline healthcare workers. So many have said, we would consider coming back coming back and working in healthcare if Bill 124 was gone, and we knew there was hope for us to get better pay and better benefits, better working conditions. Repealing it's not the silver bullet that's going to fix everything. It is very vital in the first step to showing a commitment to investing in and making working conditions better in healthcare.
Yes, thank you, Mike, for that detailed answer. I am always blown away by, again, what I call the short-term lens with regards to money. How much things cost from a purely fiscal, conservatively fiscal ideal, it would make more sense to invest more into the public system, because right now we are spending way more because it's the public purse that's paying for the private nurses and whatnot, right?
It okay. is, yes. Oh yeah, so that's public money. So yep. So when these hospitals are paying in some cases millions more for nurses, that's public money. And that public money is going to, some of it's going to the nurses themselves, and some of it's going to these private agencies who are profiting from the current situation.
Indeed, because they're beholden to their investors. I'm going to shift gears now. So it seems like the provincial government is in court a lot. Would you like to comment on the environmental lawsuit that was brought forward by young people against the Ford government?
Yeah, so I don't know if any of you have had an opportunity to follow any of the hearings this week, but so a group of young climate activists have taken the government to court. They announced it a while ago. And it's really focused on the fact that when the Ford government was first elected, they dismantled all of Ontario's climate action plans and weakened the GHG reduction targets that the province had set. And so these young folks, supported by EcoJustice, are arguing that like their future's at stake, like, and that their charter rights are at stake and being violated by the government's failure to address the climate crisis and to weaken emission reduction targets. And the interesting argument the government has made that, you know, just for me has confirmed what I've been trying to say in the legislature and asking the government repeatedly over and over again for the last 3-4 years, the government finally admitted in court that they're saying, well, this action has no standing because we have no climate plan. And your argument that the weakened reductions, GHG reductions, violate, you know, your constitutional rights have no standing because we don't have a plan to meet the targets anyway. So even if they were stronger, we wouldn't be like solving this issue for you. And I just thought, wow, like they actually under oath in court have admitted what we've all been saying, or at least I've been saying in the legislature and trying to get the premier and the environment minister to admit that they have no climate plan, that their plan is, well, let's just put it in their own words, a PR exercise. And so, you know, from my perspective, whether these young people are successful at court or not, just the public awareness that they've raised around the issue and the way in which it's forced the government to essentially admit that they have no climate plan, I think in and of itself is valuable. And you know, it's too bad this hearing didn't take place before the election instead of after the election, because I think this would have been good information for the public, because I would say the government has been somewhat effective in arguing that the expansion of electric vehicle manufacturing in the province and the investments in clean steel, significantly lowering carbon emissions in Ontario's steel industry, are, you know, great indications that the government has a climate plan and that they're addressing the climate crisis. And I would say, as somebody who has been a longtime advocate from an economic perspective, that Ontario should be helping working to make our industries global leaders in the new climate economy, and clean steel and electric vehicle manufacturing are critically important parts of that. That is wholly insufficient in and of itself to meet our climate obligations, do our fair share in reducing global climate pollution. And the court hearings this week have certainly validated that.
I just wanted to ask Mike to comment more on the implications of this strong mayor's legislation, especially in light of the municipal election. What powers really will it give to mayors, and how will that affect council votes and actions? Thanks, Mike.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. So you probably all know that I voted against the bill. And for me, I'm opposed to it for two reasons. So one is it just undermines local democracy. And I think we've seen a disturbing trend in Canada over the last few decades of a concentration of power into the Prime Minister's office and less power to, you know, cabinet ministers and backbench MPs. Which I think weakens our democracy. And we're now increasingly seeing a concentration of power in the premier's office with the same implications across the provinces as we've seen at the federal government. And now Doug Ford wants to say, hey, let's just keep this trend going and let's give the mayor more power. And so all those efforts undermine democracy. It means we have less diverse voices making decisions, and so I just think from a democratic perspective, that's a really disturbing trend we're seeing across Canada. And none of that's going to solve the housing crisis. Like, literally, like, weakening local democracy is not going to save the housing crisis. As a matter of fact, in debate, I made the point that the government's own housing task force, and I want to be very clear, I do not agree with everything the government's handpicked housing task force came up with, but they put forward 55 recommendations, and not a single one of those 55 recommendations was to give the mayor more power. As a matter of fact, the most important recommendation that I do support and have been a strong advocate for is ending exclusionary zoning. That is the most important thing. I think it's not the only thing. Like, I could give you, a 55 point plan from my perspective to go with the 55 recommendations the housing task force gave. But one of the most important ones is ending exclusionary zoning. We know that that is the fastest, least expensive, most environmentally friendly way to significantly increase housing supply within our existing built environment. I think it's just wrong. You know, an example that gets used a lot is there's many neighborhoods in the city of Toronto where you can buy a bungalow, tear it down, and build a McMansion and not go through any red tape, any process whatsoever. You can just do it. But if you want to take that bungalow and turn it in, as I toured a place in Kitchener 6 months ago, turn it into two apartments and build a tiny home, and suddenly three families have housing on the same piece of property that only one family had housing before. In many places in the province, you have to go through such a long, drawn out approval process that most people just don't do it or can't afford to do it. And so that's what ending exclusionary zoning would do. It would say that, you know what, we're going to open our neighborhoods for people to live here and not say you can't live here. And there's many other things we can do. I mean, one would be just really quickly, you know, having the province and the federal government step up and invest in co-op, nonprofit and social housing again, which if you look at most of our deeply affordable housing was built in the 1970s and 80s and was usually done in partnership with the public sector, working with the nonprofit and co-op sectors. So there's a whole host of solutions to address the housing crisis, and concentrating more power in the mayor's office isn't one of those solutions. As a matter of fact, you could have a mayor, quote, a NIMBY mayor that says, not in my backyard, and actually use their enhanced powers to stop more housing being built. So in the same way the government is saying, oh, we need strong mayors to deal, to say no to NIMBYs, you could have strong mayors say yes to NIMBYs too. So I just don't see how this legislation addresses housing. And I think the weakening of local democracy is the wrong way to go.
Thanks, Mike. It's Candace here. I'm just going to help out a little bit. So there was a question too, and I'm not sure how much you know about this particular bill, but there was an opposition bill proposed, Bill 14, the No Time to Waste Act, the Plan for Climate Action and Jobs, from the NDP. Do you have a little bit of information about what that might, you know, present to us and whether you would support it?
Yeah, so I was in the House the day the bill was introduced and went over and said that, you know, I would be happy to support and would speak in favor of and vote in favor of when the bill came before the legislature. And so I haven't had a chance to, I don't want to comment on all the details of the bill because I haven't had a chance to read it because it's not coming before the House anytime soon. You know, my just quickly glancing at it as it was being introduced in the legislature is that, you know, it's an important step forward. Any legislation that's going to help us address the climate crisis, I think is really, really important. And like with any private member's bill, it's not the comprehensive solution we need, but no private member's bill, including one for me, is the comprehensive solution. But every little piece of the puzzle that helps build that comprehensive solution, moves the province forward.
In her introduction, I made a note of it because I always chuckle at this too. She did mention the an act to enact a traditional, which it, do you want to explain to everyone what that is? Because it chuffed me when I learned about it.
Yeah, so the very first bill that comes before the legislature in any new parliament is essentially a bill to support the speech from the throne. And so that's why it has a lot of its traditional parliamentary language. And so essentially it's a vote to say whether you have confidence in the government, the vision the government's put forward in the speech from the throne. And so I voted against it. I probably for obvious reasons. But anyway, that in any new parliament is the very first bill that's always introduced.
Great. Sorry, I'm getting a few other questions here. I think there is a question about Go Metrolinks. Okay. Yeah, can you comment on the P3 that the government has signed with a European consortium to run Go?
Yeah. So I have some real concerns about this, just because we already have significant challenges, and those of us in Guelph have really felt that sort of having Metrolinks engage in a robust public consultation process. We've seen that with street closures in Guelph and obviously the proposal for the substation in Margaret Green Park. And to Metrolinks' credit, they have heard the concerns and in some cases real anger that communities have felt around lack of robust and proper public consultation. And I know Metrolinks has been working hard to learn from that and improve their processes. And I feel like we've been getting some really good progress in that regard. And I feel that, you know, they've changed plans in Guelph, at least based on public feedback, and want to thank many of the people on this particular Zoom call, as well as, you know, numerous others who aren't joining us today, have really played an important role in helping to organize the community and really make sure our voices are heard. And so I always get concerned when you have a private player now in a role of operating a public corporation, that you're going to lose that public input and decisions around the broader public good. And oftentimes we've seen from past Auditor General reports that sometimes the provision of services become more expensive too in the long run. So yeah, I have concerns, and we'll be monitoring that and really pushing hard to make sure that Metrolinks makes decisions around both the operation and expansion of Go services, that they're done in the broad public interest.
Thank you, Mike. I have one more question. So the NDP recently announced their welfare diet program, and it's for 2 weeks. And the question is, would you be willing to take part in this diet for a month and report your findings that a single ODSP recipient faces, because it would help to paint a fuller picture of the what we will call enforced poverty faced by many Ontarians.
Yeah, so I've been complimentary of the NDP members who have done this to shine a brighter light and to highlight the real personal challenges and implications of legislated poverty. I also have had people who are strong social justice advocates and anti-poverty activists reach out to me and be very critical of this approach, saying that, you know, cosplay by middle-class elected officials is not the most appropriate way forward. And so I wanted to honor those voices as well. And so I think, so I have mixed feelings. We'll put it this way. I don't want to be critical of MPPs who have made that decision or are doing that. So the approach I'm trying to take is to center the voices of people who are experiencing legislated poverty and to have the conversation about the personal implications of that come from them and not from me. Like, I feel like my role is the role I've been playing at Queen's Park is, you know, I'm the first MPP who has called for the doubling of ODSP rates. You know, I've been in many cases leading the charge here at Queen's Park in terms of the allocation of my questions, debate time, et cetera, to continue pushing for ending legislated poverty. And so I'm really at this point, I've been working with strategies around how we center and amplify the voices of people with lived experience. And then my role being to advocate on the policy front. And so that's the approach I've chosen to take. And those are kind of the rationale and reasons of why I've chosen to take that approach. But I certainly do not in any way want that to be viewed as a criticism of people who are taking a different approach, because I think everyone and anyone who's highlighting this issue is really important. And I want to just say that, you know, what motivated me to be the first and to really lead the charge on this is conversations I've had with people in Guelph and who are on ODSP and people who've come to Queen's Park on the front lawn. And I'm pointing out here because I'm looking at that front lawn, to voice their concerns and to protest. And I made a commitment to say that, you know, doubling ODSP rates was something I would prioritize. And so I just want to say that I feel like the partnership I've made with ODSP and let's include Ontario Works as well. So people on social assistance, the partnership to say, this is what you've asked for, let's end legislative poverty. So that partnership has really sparked a conversation. Like a year and a half ago, nobody was talking about increasing social assistance rates. And anyone who was saying double them was sort of told, whoa, like you're so far out of the mainstream. Why would we even listen to you? And now it's part of the mainstream conversation. And so I just want to, as much as possible, continue that partnership and center those voices as much as I can.
Okay, excellent. I'm just gonna do a little bit of a lightning round. And that involves the question, what should we watch for over the next 6 months? And I'll just give you a few suggestions. Education negotiations, public sector contracts. Are we in for a long cold winter of strikes and labor unrest?
Well, I think that depends on the government. If the government is going to recognize that we have 8% inflation and that negotiate in a fair way and in a way that really enhances public services, then we won't be. And if the government decides to go a different route, then, you know, we may be. And I want to say that by saying thank you to education workers who in the year before the pandemic went into job action. I know this is lightning round, but this is important. Went into job action for lower class sizes and no to mandatory e-learning. And thank goodness after the last 2.5 years of the pandemic that our students did not have to be in even bigger classes. And I think the pandemic is really highlighted why mandatory e-learning is such a bad idea.
Okay, thank you. Do you have any thoughts about COVID? What can we expect this winter?
I'm not an epidemiologist or public health care or public health official, so I don't want to get into the predictions game, but I would just say that most health experts are saying that we'll see an increase in COVID cases and COVID hospitalizations as we move forward. And so, you know, I would really encourage folks to, you know, make sure you're up to date on your vaccines, wear masks where appropriate, and continue to push the government to make the investments in publicly funded, publicly delivered healthcare, and in the things like improved ventilation in our schools, lower class sizes and things like that, 10 paid sick days. I mean, I could give you a whole list of like supports that people need in order to help reduce COVID risk.
Yes, we've known for over 2 years about the benefits of improved ventilation, and I feel like we've kind of dropped that ball somewhat. And I hope that it doesn't come to this, but you know, I hope that there isn't the need for masking mandates again. One more quick question. I should have put this in the lightning round. What about daycare? People are concerned that the government is not moving quickly enough on the daycare.
Yeah, I'm a big supporter of the federal $10 a day child care program. And the biggest challenge in my conversations with child care operators is the lack of clarity in starting in 2023 and what that means for their ability to operate their facilities. And the other concern is, and this is something I raised from day one and we'll continue to push on, is that only paying ECEs, early childhood educators, $18 an hour versus the $25 that Manitoba and other provinces are paying and that I'm advocating for, means that a lot of daycare childcare providers are worried they're going to not have the staff to be able to accommodate the need of parents. And so it gets back to this whole issue of, you know, let's invest in the caring economy and the people who deliver that care, whether it's long-term care, healthcare, child care, educating students. Like, let's actually invest in the people who deliver care and important public services to people in our communities.
Okay. Thank you, Mike, for being here today. I was just wondering if you would like to say anything to sum up.
Yeah, so I know we've probably gone over time, and I just want to say, like, citizen public engagement in the political process is so vitally important. And that's one of the things that I deeply value about, you know, opportunities like Breezy Breakfast. And so I would say to all of you, like, please stay politically engaged through the municipal election that's obviously coming up, the work I do at Queen's Park, the work that's being done in the federal government, and just make sure your voices are heard and that you organize and connect with our neighbors here in Guelph to make sure our collective voice in Guelph is heard. And so just thank you for your political engagement and just, you know, keep asking me tough questions.
Thank you, Mike, for being here. And we appreciate your efforts at Queen's Park, big time.
You're welcome. Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Have your say. The Guelph Reformatory District Study, the proposed boundary of the Ontario Reformatory Heritage Conservation District area, is being studied. There is an in-person consultation at the Royal Canadian Legion Thursday, September 29th from 6:30 to 8 p.m. And online, you can have your say from the 29th to October 13th. You can have your say about the Stormwater Management Master Plan. the reconstruction of Whitelaw Road, the downtown renewal project, and the new community engagement plan. Please go to haveyoursay.guelph.ca to have your say. Oh my goodness, there are so many vacancies in the advisory committees. Please apply by September the 22nd. This weekend, there is going to be downtown live music because the Jazz Festival is happening at One Cardin Street on September the 23rd at 8 p.m. Baja Bulat is playing at the Royal City Mission. This is something new. There is a program called the Children's Reading Room at 210 Silver Creek Parkway North. And they are having a Booktoberfest and fund drive on Saturday, October 1st from 10 to 2 p.m. So please bring some donations, clothing, household textiles, and so that they can raise money. And there will be crafts there for your kids and for kids at heart. Please get to know your candidates for the municipal election. There are questionnaires being answered on Guelph Politico, and please check out Guelph Today for interviews. I believe the Mercury Tribune is also doing questionnaires, as are other organizations. And I'll get more information about that for our next Breezy Breakfast meeting. The federal riding redistribution proposal is out. Please have your say by September 25th. Guelph is affected in that the south end of Guelph will be put into a different riding. And remember, this is based on population numbers in Ontario. And finally, I want to remind everybody that on September 22nd, next week, there is no show. On September 29th, there is an open mic. On October 6th, Stephen O'Brien, who is the chief returning officer, will give us a talk about all things municipal election. So please have your questions ready for him. On October 13th, our MP Lloyd Longfield will be here. On October 20th, there will be no show. And October 27th, we will have our post-election post-mortem. And with that, I would like to thank everyone for attending today, and that's a wrap.
Thanks for joining us today. Music is provided by Juice Germ. I'm Jayu, the producer of the Breezy Breakfast Radio Hour. Breezy Breakfast, where the coffee is hot and the discussion is even hotter.